We were calling it hurricane season, and we actually cold called ESPN Films.
Welcome to Beyond the Lens, presented by Diesel Films. I am Seth Shapiro.
And I'm AJ Speaks.
In this episode, we welcome documentary legend Billy Corbin. As a college student at the University of Miami, Billy was the youngest director to ever premiere at Sundance with his film Raw Deal, A Question of Consent. Billy followed that up with Cocaine Cowboys, Miami's real-life version of Scarface, which electrified viewers worldwide. With his foothold on the Magic City, Billy documented his alma mater's football dynasty, the U, for ESPN's 30 for 30.
He takes us back to when he was a child actor in Ron Howard's movie Parenthood and explains how that experience spurred his love of filmmaking. He walks us through his pitch of the U to ESPN and details what it was like working with Uncle Luke to score the doc. And you don't want to miss Billy tell us the film he would like to make about a certain NBA front office that has won a few championships. It is time for Beyond the Lens by Diesel Films.
Big, big show today. An absolute legend in the documentary space and the director of my favorite documentary of all time, Cocaine Cowboys. I remember carrying around the DVD. We welcome Billy Corbin to Beyond the Lens. Billy, how's it going?
Thanks for having me, Seth.
It's an honor. You know, we like to break this podcast into three acts, and the first act is your story. Where did you grow up and, you know, where did your love of storytelling come from?
I was born in Fort Myers, Florida, on the West Coast, and my family moved down to Miami, North Miami Beach, to be precise, a city with beach in its name and no beach in its borders. And we moved here when I was about 3 years old, shortly after my little brother was born. And so I've been a lifelong Florida native and lifelong Miamian. And I really, my enthusiasm for filmmaking started very young. I was about five or six years old when I saw a friend from the neighborhood who was on a Sears commercial. I'll never forget. She was riding a bicycle in this commercial. And I got very excited that a person that I knew from real life was on television. I did not excel in athletics the way my brother did. My brother was a very gifted athlete in his childhood. I, on the other hand, my first at-bat at the North Miami Beach Optimist T-Ball League, I struck out. So that was the end of my father's baseball dreams, you know, for me. And so I started to do what this friend was doing. And I started after school, my activity was going out on auditions for commercials, mostly because Miami back then in the 80s, just a ton of commercials and modeling and you know, catalogs and just a ton of shit back then. And so every single day there was an audition to go on, and I wound up booking a job on, you name a product sector, and I did a commercial for it. Fast food, detergent, sandwich meats, toys, like banks, whatever it was that they were shooting in Miami, I did a commercial for it. And then Ron Howard came to town having auditions for a movie called Parenthood, with Steve Martin and Keanu Reeves and Joaquin Phoenix and a ton of incredible actors. And they shot it in Orlando at what would later become Universal, but was just at that point not very much a theme park quite yet. And so I got a part in that movie. And I think that was, I think seeing Ron Howard, who, you know, as a kid, I watched a lot of Nick at Night, you know, I watched a lot of, so we watched Happy Days, watched the Andy Griffith Show. And here was a guy in Ron Howard that I saw on TV as a kid, who now is clearly a recovering child actor, but now he was like in charge of everything. He was the director, and he was not only a fantastic director, but like his whole set was like a family affair. His wife was there, his daughter was there, his father was there, his brother was there. They were all in the movie, either in small parts or big parts. And it was just like fun. Like that was the moment I think that I realized that maybe if there is a future in this, that would be the future as a director. And so it was really that I think started me on this path.
So take us to the next step. Once you realize that's the path you want to go on, what do you do next?
Well, I mean, at that point, I was still a kid. I was still an actor, but in TV production class in middle school at Highland Oaks, which is in like North Miami Beach, Aventura area, I met Alfred Spellman, who to this day is my producing partner, along with David Sipkin, who I've known since preschool in North Miami Beach. And Alfred and I, we had a teacher named Sheila Spicer, our TV production teacher, who just identified something in us, a certain kind of drive and interest in production. And she literally handed us the keys to the studio, the TV production studio at Highland Oaks Middle, and put us in charge of producing the daily morning news show that was aired on the closed circuit television in the school. And Alfred and I produced that for, you know, the whole year. And she's the one who really paired us up, who partnered us together. And Alfred's been my producing partner ever since. We started our first production company after that when we were sophomores in high school. We decided that for our community service project that we needed, the hours that we needed to graduate from Miami-Dade Public Schools, that we were going to do a video. This is back in 94, back when AIDS education was just starting to happen in public schools. And we decided to make a video basically by kids for kids that teachers could show in their classroom that would cover a lot of the AIDS education curriculum. And we produced that during like our spring break or something in like 94. And it premiered at World AIDS Day at a museum in downtown Miami in late 94. And then that became, believe it or not, our first project that we got a distributor. It was one of the biggest educational video distributors of the time, and it was distributed all over the world and wound up in elementary and middle school classes. And I heard many, many years later in Miami, teachers were still using it. I don't know if it was on VHS still or if they finally upgraded to DVD, but they were still using it in their classrooms. And that was kind of the start of our of Alfred and Dave and I working together as a legitimate production entity as sophomores in high school. And then wound up about 6-7 years later, we wound up as the youngest filmmakers at the time in the history of the Sundance Film Festival with our first documentary.
Isn't it amazing how that teacher connected you guys and that became the springboard for the rest of your life?
Oh, absolutely. Sheila Spicer was an extraordinary educator. She's retired now, is an extraordinary woman. She, one day I met Brad Meltzer, the renowned author and TV host. He actually has Seth's haircut. And he lived in like similar neighborhood. He's a little bit older than I am, but grew up in that neighborhood. And he tells a story. I think he wrote about it in one of his books. He went into creative writing class, I think, at NMB, at North Miami Beach Senior High School. Go Chargers. And he goes into this creative writing class. And on day one, the teacher tells the class, I want you to do this sample kind of essay so I can get a feel for your skill level and everything. So everybody turns in this essay. The next day he comes in, she hands the papers back, and she says something to him or writes it on the paper like, stay after class today. So he's concerned that maybe he's in trouble or he needs some remedial courses or who knows what. So the teacher says to him, listen, you have a natural talent. You have a gift. I want you to spend this entire year sitting in the back of the room, not listening to a single word I say, because I don't want to do anything to tamper with what I think is your natural gift. You have to do all the homework because I got to grade you, but don't listen to what I'm teaching. You do you, do your own thing. That is why he is a best-selling author today. And that woman was Sheila Spicer, was the same teacher who later in life went on to teach drama and TV production at Highland Oaks Middle and put Alfred and I together. So this is an extraordinary woman who changed the lives of a lot of the students that she came into contact with. The only thing more inspiring than a good teacher is a bad teacher, which I also had my fair share of in the Dade County Public Schools, mind you. But Sheila Spicer was not one of the good ones. She was one of the extraordinary ones. She was one of the special ones that changes people's lives.
Big salute to Sheila Spicer. Good story.
You have become the historian of the corruption in Miami. Where did that come from, and how did that start?
Because the unofficial ombudsman of the entire county.
because Miami.
Hashtag because my, you know, I think it was born out of, I mean, you grow up in this community and you realize pretty quickly that, like, you know, Alfred Spellman, my producing partner, he compares Miami and Florida at large, but Miami specifically, to the little town in the movie Breakdown with Kurt Russell, you know, where kind of everybody in the town is in on this hustle, from the gas station attendant to the sheriff. Everybody's there. You know, some, you know, people drive through town, they kidnap the wife, they hold her for ransom, the guy's got to pay, you know, like, this is just what they do. And it's, Miami's kind of like that. You know, we rely on people coming in from the outside. We kind of turn you upside down by your ankles, shake all the money out of your pockets. And, you know, everybody divvies it up in town and every, you know, and then you go back home kind of, you know, broke and dazed and said, wow, Miami's a lot of fun, you know? But like, you know, so it's a hustle town. It's because we have very little indigenous industry. We subsist from hustle to hustle, you know, from, we exist in boom and bust cycles. And so we live from boom to boom and how to artificially inflate those bubbles, you know? It's always a hustle. And so a lot of people are in on it. So a lot of people here who, if you're in hospitality, if you're in real estate, if you're in construction or development or the restaurant business, whatever, or the nightclub business, whatever you're doing, it's not really a self-sustaining economy. It's all designed to attract tomorrow's newcomers, right? It's all designed to, it's all built on growth, unsustainable growth. We are a peninsula. There's a finite amount of space. There's a finite amount of resources. It is an unsustainable economy. But yet everybody's in on it. Nobody wants to talk shit because they are reliant on the new investment, the outside people, the new arrivals, the growth. And so, you know, somebody's got to call it out. Someone has to say, you know, if you really love this place, you have to say, you know, you got to hang a lantern on the problems. You go, what's the saying? We only roast the ones we love, you know. But the reality is that how are you going to make anything better unless you acknowledge that there is a problem, that there is a toxicity? There's arguably a cancer on this community. And it is by and large the political class, you know, the political grifters and the dynastic kind of political crime families who have been feeding at the public trough and victimizing this community and the taxpayers for generations. Someone has to call that out. And there's not a lot of people, incidentally, in a position to do so for two reasons. Number one, their livelihood is connected to the lie. You know, the livelihood is connected to the hustle. So they don't want to call it out because you know, the second you sort of start to poke holes in this facade, everybody realizes it's, you know, it's bullshit. And the second reason is a lot of people are scared because a lot of people depend on these government officials. I mean, we have a, you know, government here where you have politicians and bureaucrats who will illegally and unconstitutionally target private businesses and shut them down, you know, kind of use code enforcement of the police department as their own personal tauntaun macoot to target private business owners and to target political enemies. And so people really are legitimately scared into silence. They have managed, many of the politicians in this town, to effectively stifle dissent out of fear. What kind of corrupt horseshit is that? What kind of, you know, third world communist authoritarian dictatorship nonsense is that? Okay, this is the United States of America, and we have to speak truth to power, and we have to talk about the dysfunction and corruption of our government. It's the only way. The first step, as you know, first step in recovery is acknowledging that there's a problem. And so the people, there's nobody in denial in Miami. There's people who are just lying, okay, and they're lying because that is their business. Their business is for people to believe the myth that we're a tech hub, that we are Hollywood East, that we are a modern art community. None of these things ever come to pass, but it's damn helpful in selling real estate and building condos and renting hotel rooms and booking restaurants and nightclubs and bottle service. And so you know, everybody says the rising tide raises all ships. And that leads us to the other problem. The rising tide will eventually stop raising our ships and eventually sink us. And nobody seems to care. As long as the checks are clearing and the Bitcoin is is flying and the cash is raining. I mean, everybody seems to be cool. And then at some point, there's just not. It's a disposable city. And at some point, hopefully, I mean, not in our lifetimes, you know, it will be underwater and then everybody will just move on to the next disposable, this disposable city. So that's the happy ending.
We've lit the fire, everybody. We've lit the fire.
You finish Raw Deal and then you start, I assume, what is becomes your next huge project in Cocaine Cowboys. Does that start immediately? How long does that take? What is the process of that project?
No, it took a couple years for us to decide what to do. We had spent an entire year plus on this, our first documentary. And so, you know, we needed to figure out what the hell we were going to do next. We kind of went to Sundance a little unprepared. You know, we didn't have anything else to pitch. We didn't know what our next thing was going to be. And so we did like, the movie blew up at Sundance. We did like 60 interviews in 5 or 6 days with press from all over the world. Our Doc was the first movie to sell out all of its screenings at Sundance in advance, and it was a whirlwind experience. And so the last question of every interview was always the same. Everybody would say, "Okay, now that you have arrived, right? Are you guys going to go to New York? Are you going to go to LA? You know, what's the next move?" And you know, as obvious as it was to them that we would move to New York or LA, you know, industry meccas. It was just as obvious to us that we were going to come back to Miami, which is what we told everybody. We're going to go back home. I mean, first of all, you know, home is where you go when you're done with other shit. You know, that's why they call it home. So there was that, along with the fact that we had this idea, call it a gamble, call it an investment. Gamble is probably more accurate, but that we were going to tell stories from our hometown, about our hometown or home state, that we were going to develop Florida fuckery as our nonfiction genre. It had been a genre in nonfiction and certainly in fiction, but not really in nonfiction filmmaking and documentary filmmaking. And we just saw it as this extraordinary untapped resource for documentarians and for real life stories that we wanted to embrace and help export. Florida fuckery is our top export, actually, other than I think oranges and machine guns that are made in Florida. But that's what we wanted to do. We didn't want to be three more schmucks peddling our wares in New York and L.A. like everybody else who has a big Sundance premiere or debut. You know, we wanted to be the Miami guys. You know, we knew that. Nobody might know who Alfred Spellman was or David Sipkin or Raconteur, our company, but we were hoping that like they would know us as the Miami guys or the Florida guys, you know, like there's a lot of filmmakers and, you know, Spike Lee in New York or Martin Scorsese in New York, Richard Linklater and Robert Rodriguez in Austin, Tarantino in LA, and like Shyamalan and Philly and, you know, Pennsylvania and rural Pennsylvania. In Baltimore, John Waters and David Simon and Barry Levinson, like people, Kevin Smith in New Jersey, you know, like you just associate those filmmakers with their geography. And so we wanted to do that. We wanted to kind of, you know, bootstrap, if you will, our brand onto Miami, which we felt was not a provincial move, but an international move. It's an international city. Everybody wants to be in Miami. That's the reason most people hate Miami is because they wish they were here. You know, people love to hate Miami. I hate to love it, I think, is my problem. But yeah, I think that's true of a lot of people who are here. But like, that was our move. And to that end, we needed to develop a project that was going to be our calling card, right? That was going to herald the arrival of our brand. And so we developed this idea called City Made of Snow about the cocaine boom, really about our childhoods, if you will, like to sort of explain what was happening here in Miami when we were growing up. So like that was the idea. Of course, we later changed the title to Cocaine Cowboys. And certainly I think, again, I think the investment or the gamble paid off, you know, the idea that we were going to be. So then we weren't the Miami guys per se, but everybody was like, oh, the Cocaine Cowboys guys. Right. So that, which is okay too. It's better to be known for something than for nothing at all.
John Roberts, may rest in peace, and Mickey Monday, probably the two greatest interviews in documentary history. How did you find them? And, you know, how did that process start working with John and Mickey on that, on Cocaine Cowboys?
Yeah, and I'd argue Jorge Rivera, George, a.k.a. George Rivera, the hitman who we interview in the latter half of the doc. Here's something interesting about it. So we started getting these. We got an angel investor on board because we pitched it everywhere. After Sundance, we could get interviews anywhere and everywhere. So, but in those days, you have to remember, there was gatekeepers, man. Like, you know, this is right at the dawn of YouTube, you know, barely at the dawn of YouTube, actually. YouTube launched in like, what, 04, 05, you know, so, and certainly, you know, Netflix was, you know, just a DVD service, you know, at that point. Cocaine Cowboys blew up at Netflix on the red envelope. Remember the red envelopes, you know, coming in? Yeah, so.
I had it.
Yeah, so we've pitched City Made of Snow everywhere. But again, there was only like 8 or 9 companies, you know, theatrical distribution companies for documentaries. So those executives were the gatekeepers. If you could not penetrate or capture the imagination of those, that finite, very small number, you know, not even double digits number of companies, you would get nowhere, you know. And if you could not then get into a film festival, you got nowhere. You know, there was no other way to kind of, you know, go direct to your end user or your audience or, you know, so we could not sell City Made of Snow. We could not get industry financing for it. Nobody got it. Everybody said, like, didn't we see this in Blow? Didn't we see this in Scarface? Wasn't this in Miami Vice? And we're like, yeah, but this is a documentary. Like, how many times are you going to tell the Al Capone story or an Italian gangster story? Like, this is a different, we obviously failed to, I don't know if they failed to get
it's real life. It's real life.
Yeah, we failed to pitch it, perhaps, but like we could not get anybody interested. So we got an angel investor just to get started and to get those initial interviews in the can. And we knew pretty early, like, this was something kind of cool and special, you know, and because of the content of those interviews, John's and Mickey's and Rivy's and even, you know, the lawyers and the cops and the journalists that we interviewed, everything was pretty, it was wild. It was just, you know, everybody was very raw and candid and it was really, really compelling stuff. And in fact, I'll tell you this, as we started to edit it, David Sipkin and I edited it in the second bedroom of my apartment in Miami. We converted it into an edit suite. He and I worked literally back to back. I would face one Final Cut Pro system. He would face the other. And we started editing this thing. And so there was a moment, this is wild. So there's a moment where we're in the edit and we call up Alfred, our producing partner, and we say, okay, listen, we have the first cut, right? We have a rough cut. And Alfred says, how long is it? And I say, it's like, it's 3.5 hours. He goes, fuck you, keep cutting. And he hung up. And so Dave and I started cutting. And then we started talking. And then we started drinking and talking some more. And we called Alfred back within a day or two. And we said, listen, here's the thing. It's 4 hours long. It's not actually a feature documentary. I don't know if that means it's 2 2-hour docs or it's 4 1-hour docs, but the first half is about the cocaine boom, right? The this industry and how it blows up and the money just pours into, you know, this narco economy into Miami and helps build the city. Second half is basically the downfall. It's about the enforcement and the murderers that basically kill the golden goose, as Mickey Munday says in the documentary. So those are the two halves to the story. You know, I said, so basically we, you know, and we talked about what that meant structurally and how we would introduce Rivy. We would hold Rivy and introduce the hitman in the second half rather than integrate him as a commentator in the first half. And honest to God, for the next day or two, we worked under the guise that this was the concept. And then I remember Alfred called and he said, listen, because, you know, Dave and I handle the creative side of the business, whereas Alfred handles like the business side of our company. And Alfred says, listen, it's hard enough to go out into the marketplace and sell one independent feature documentary. He said, we can't reinvent the wheel. There's no such thing as like a double feature or a doc mini series. He's like, there's no such thing as that. You know, and he's like, we can't go out into the marketplace with something that's with an unsellable product. He said, let's just cut the best feature doc that we can. And then maybe there'll be opportunities in the future to do some ancillary projects or things with it. And so we went back to, you know, cutting it down to 2 hours. And so, which we eventually did. But what's funny about that is flash forward, you know, less than a decade. And we would go to buyers in the last few years with feature documentaries. And they would say to us, can this be 6 hours? Can this be 10 hours? So we practically invented the documentary miniseries in 2005 and nobody knows about it because we talked ourselves out of it, you know, and which I thought was pretty funny. And then incredibly, when Cocaine Cowboys blew up in the bootleg market, which is where it first blew up, at the flea markets, at barbershops, in Miami Gardens, in Carroll City, and the Carroll Mart, and you know, really very much in the hip hop community and the flea markets that would, like, you know, would perpetuate bootlegs. It went viral before viral was a thing. It went viral on DVDRs, you know, on physical media. People told me that they ripped the bootleg and put an MP3 of the entire movie soundtrack, all 2 hours of it, on their iPod and would listen to it in the car. And years later, I'm like, we fucking invented Audible and podcasts. That would have been like the first serialized, like, but we could have fucking made a podcast out of Cocaine Cowboy because it's nonstop talking, right? And music and stuff. So I was like, that's hilarious. We could have made it a podcast too. Holy shit.
Everything. I want to ask just one more thing about, for our listeners, about the Rivi Ayala interview, which was done at the jail. For our listeners, how do you set up, and for myself, how do you set up an interview at a jail? How do they allow cameras in? How do they allow him to talk? Kind of just give us the brief story about that.
Federal prisons, the BOP, do not allow cameras, or have not allowed cameras in their places since Timothy McVeigh was interviewed for like 60 minutes before his execution. And state prisons are a little bit different. You know, there are individual, obviously, each of the different you know, departments of corrections in different states have different policies. Then the wardens have a lot of, you know, have a lot of power over determining who can and can't, and if we will or won't come into their institutions, and rightfully so. They're responsible for security there. And fortunately, we just encountered you know, very willing and transparent Florida Department of Corrections in those days. I don't know what it's like now, but in those days, you know, the public and, you know, the press had access to those institutions. So we arranged it through the Department of Corrections, and then more importantly through the wardens. And I think we may have shot, if I recall correctly, there was at least two, because we did three interviews, I think, with Rivi in two different facilities. And attempted a third, and attempted an interview at another facility in the Panhandle with Miguel Perez, another one of Griselda Blanco's alleged hitmen, who we went there and set up the interview, and he came in the room and said he's not doing. His lawyer told him not to do it, and this was after we went through all of the rigmarole of we visited him first without cameras, and we came back. We made all the arrangements through the through the prison and the warden, and we went there. We checked in all of our equipment. They searched us. They told us, you know, you can't bring, you know, one of our crew members had like, you know, a little tool kit that had a Leatherman. Obviously you can't bring, you know, anything that could double as a weapon. And so we went through this whole and then set up for hours. I mean, we drove into the, you know, pre-dawn, we drove into the Panhandle. I mean, like, it was this whole, and then he comes in and says, I can't do it. My lawyer said not to do it. And Alfred's like, you could have told us before we came all the way up here and set up and everything. So that was an interview that we never got.
Last teacher point for me on this part, before we move to Act Two, you mentioned angel investors, and everybody may not be familiar with the term or how that process worked. Can you briefly explain that to our listeners? And then for your angel investor, I guess it was worth it for them in the back end.
In the long run. Yeah. I mean, listen, find a rich friend. I mean, that's what an angel investor is. It's a rich friend with some disposable income who can afford to lose it. But most importantly, what an angel investor is someone who is less investing in the project and more investing in you. you know, who believes in you, who likes you, who really just says like, you know, I want Billy and Alfred and Dave to have a shot, you know, and that was our angel investor, was someone who's just like, listen, these guys did it with, you know, with Raw Deal of Question Consent, went to Sundance with it. You know, just these three kids from Miami, who moved to Gainesville and made a documentary, and a year later were at the Sundance Film Festival, you know, let's give them another shot. And so that's, I mean, that's what an angel is. It's someone willing to write you a check to help make your dreams come true. Hence angel. And that's how Cocaine Cowboys got off the ground. Even after having this, you know, this so-called success at Sundance, like that didn't get us, anywhere in terms of industry financing. We were back to the drawing board, back to square one, and having to, you know, peddle our wares. But fortunately we found someone willing to give us a chance.
A well-deserved act one, but we're going to enter into
long act one. 30, if you're going by screenwriting rules, 30, 60,
we're out
30
the Everglades
rules.
Now. We're out the Everglades.
30-60-30 is the basic structure for a 2-hour, you know, 120-page screenplay. So Act One is 30, Act Two is 60, and then Act Three is 30 again. So we are way the fuck over.
Oh man, Act Two. We're gonna focus on your 30 for 30 debut, the Dynasty, the America's Team at the time, the U. Highest rated 30 for 30 in history. Talk about
time. We've been outdone.
Yeah. I'm sure The Last Dance, if that's considered a 30 for 30.
Well, first Broke, actually. Broke, we outdid ourselves. And then, yeah, and then some of the subs. I mean, the OJ, the brilliant OJ doc, oh, yeah. You know, and which was just a mic drop of the 30 for 30s, you know, just a masterpiece.
How did ESPN come to you? And I mean, it must have been a dream come true to do a doc about the U.
Yeah, it was basically, the pitch was like, you know, Cocaine Cowboys, but about the Miami Hurricanes. That was basically the pitch. So that makes it, when you have a shorthand like that, it makes it an easier sell. But we were calling it Hurricane Season, and we actually cold called ESPN Films back in 07, maybe. We cold called ESPN Films. 30 for 30 wasn't a thing. Didn't even exist. I don't even know that Bill Simmons had come up with it yet. So we called them up, and Connor Shell picked up the phone, and he was like a Miami guy. He had spent a lot of time down here. He was familiar with the story. He knew Cocaine Cowboys. He knew our work. And he literally picked up his own phone. He later went on to run the entire fucking, you know, division and company. Yeah. But at the time, he was literally answering his own phone. And we pitched him. And we had a great, you know, fully illustrated deck. And Hurricane Season was going to cover all five national championships. We were very ambitious. At the jump, we were like, yeah, we're going to do this whole thing. Obviously, it became pretty clear as we started that this was going to be a team of the 80s story, and that because the 01 thing is its own. I mean, it's, you know, it's practically, it's literally the next generation. It's like Star Trek, the Next Generation, you know. So like, we knew that, like, how are we going to cover the decade, you know, practically in between, you know, the national championships and what happened in that period. And we always joked, maybe someday it'll be the first 30 for 30 sequel. You know, we'll get to do that story, which is funny because we did the same thing with Cocaine Cowboys. I told you, Alfred's like, let's just do this one feature doc. And then maybe if anybody sees it or likes it or catches on, maybe we'll have an opportunity. And now we're on like our fourth title in the Cocaine Cowboys franchise, and kind of the same thing happened with the U, where we joked like maybe we'll do the 01 team as a sequel someday, but you know, that was a pipe dream, we thought. So anyway,
and you did.
And we did, yeah. It's a spoiler alert. Yeah. So they were very receptive. Specifically, there was an executive there who was running ESPN Films, which was a small division within the mothership, you know, the beast that is ESPN. ESPN Films was a very small division with just a handful of really very dedicated and very smart and obviously very sports literate people. And it was headed up at the time by an executive named Keith Klingscales, who really at that time championed it. And if it hadn't been for Keith, I don't think the U would have gotten made. He also titled it. He changed the title from Hurricane Season to the U, which was obviously, again, the right move from a marketing standpoint. If only so later it would rhyme with the U Part Two. We went and that was a tough pitch, I got to tell you. like we went and pitched a small group, and then we wound up in Bristol, Connecticut at the mothership in this giant, really rather intimidating conference room with this like ridiculously long table packed with people. I mean, every seat was taken, and here was Alfred and I, you know, these two little white boys coming in, like telling with like stars in our eyes, telling the story about the greatest show on earth, which we witnessed in part at the Orange Bowl as little kids, you know? And so obviously though, it was a story for us about, you know, racial tensions in a community that was home to not one, not two, but three uprisings as a result of African-Americans being killed by unarmed African-Americans being killed by white and or Hispanic police officers over the course of the decade. Arthur McDuffie in 79 with riots in 1980, Louis Alvarez in 84, and then Lozano in 89, and Miami burned during the Super Bowl at Joe Robbie Stadium in January of 1989. And so, you know, we wanted, that was very much the backdrop of the story, was this community ravaged by the cocaine wars, by the Mariel Boatlift, by the McDuffie demonstrations. And so that was the, you know, that was the context that we wanted to tell it, in no small part because, you know, the best sports documentaries are the ones that are the least about sports. So wherever you get to bring in modern history, you know, contemporaneous history, pop culture, wherever you get to do that, obviously, is incredibly advantageous. Because sports docs are, sports stories in general are pretty easy. They're like cheating because sports in general has all of the drama built into it. You know, like overcoming adversity, you know, creatively overcoming obstacles, you know, people cheering at the end. Like, it's just, it has a lot of the stuff that you like. You know, if you think about even mediocre or bad sports movies, they're still pretty watchable, whether it's a scripted movie or a documentary. Like, even bad sports stuff is pretty entertaining, or you can still sort of just like, you know, veg out on the couch and watch a mediocre sports movie and be pretty well entertained. So we wanted to, obviously our goals were a little bit loftier with it, to tell a story of Miami in the kind of way that we did with Cocaine Cowboys, you know, make Miami a character in the story. And ESPN was down, I think, because Keith championed it though. I really do, and really mentored us and shepherded us through that process, and then through the production. He really had our back, and I think that matters. You know, having a co-signer, I think, you know, matters. And not to mention, you know, even more helpful when he's the head of ESPN Films, obviously. But really went to bat for us and let us do our thing. Because remember, we produced that entirely from Miami, and then delivered it. You know, went up for like the last week or so to Connecticut to deliver it to them, but otherwise it was entirely made down here in Miami. And once again, I think our gamble of building our brand in and around Miami, you know, we always found that some of our friends from New York or Bristol, Connecticut would always find a reason to expense a business trip to Miami in February. If you hear what I'm screaming,
always,
you
know? Yeah,
always a reason to come down from New England, you know, during the winter for a business trip, just to Miami Beach.
Especially at that time.
Oh, yeah, we get that all the time. Oh, they show up for a Heat game. Oh, you just happened to show up at this time of the year. Of course you did.
Yeah. So, you know, so that was always fun. But again, I think that was a place where our investing in our geography, you know, became a big part of our success.
First of all, I thought that you did a wonderful job in that, watching it back again and taking people and showing them how different it is in Liberty City and Overtown to Coral Gables, and then tying that into what you were just talking about with the two Miamis back in the day with the Miami Beach and Overtown with Muhammad Ali and them. So I thought that was a wonderful way to weave that. But my question to you really is right now, what is your directorial process? How long did it take you? Did you start with the end? Did you start with the beginning? I know you said, hey, we're going to pick, you ended up picking these 4 years and four championships, but how do you go through that process of breaking that down and deciding where to start and where to stop? And how long does that whole thing take? Or how long did it take for this thought?
Well, obviously a very popular structure and storytelling arc is the rise and fall, You know, if you look at a lot of our docs, you know, they are about Miami, but they're ultimately about the pursuit of the American dream by any means necessary. And so I think that those are, you know, those types of Horatio Alger stories or the American dream gone awry or whatever you want to call them. I mean, it's Tony Montana essentially is what it is. I think those are very popular conceits in storytelling. And so that was really what we wanted to do was tell the rise and fall of this dynasty of the team of the 80s, mind you, because of course it would resurge in the late 90s, early aughts, but specifically ours in the U part one was a team of the 80s story. In fact, that would have been the subtitle if we had the U: the team of the 80s, you know, because it was nothing like that, obviously, you know, and so like that program in that era. And so both athletically and culturally, I think. And so one of the first things that we try to do is try to lock down a look, right? What is this going to look like? What's it going to feel like? What's the aesthetic? What's kind of the color scheme? When you're making a sports documentary, color schemes are easy because you go for the colors of the team, you know, usually, you know, when you're talking about backdrops of interviews or lower thirds or whatever it's going to be, you go, and then you want to know what it's going to sound like, you know, because I look at a lot of these documentaries as musicals. And AJ, you mentioned something, you know, pretty crucial there, critical about the understanding, you know, the different municipalities and neighborhoods and fiefdoms of Miami-Dade County. And one of the things we did to represent Coral Gables, for example, it's a very one of the wealthiest neighborhoods in Miami-Dade County. You know, we represented Coral Gables with a string quartet, a very kind of like, you know, classical sounding, almost stuffy kind of a melody played by actually four. I think all those string players were actually from the University of Miami who played in the orchestra. And then when the players start to come in, we did this like 808 remix, like this kind of Miami, you know, bass era remix of where we took the string quartet and chopped it up and started to, you know, and so, but to me that is so much about the identity of the story and how people invest emotionally and understand, you know, sometimes people will smile. It's actually my ringtone, that cue. It's still to this day my ringtone, that particular piece of music. It starts out with the string quartet and then it goes, you know. And so, you know, but we try to dictate all of that as early as possible. So like the director of photography and the gaffer and the composers and the editors, like everybody and the motion graphics people, everybody's on the same page. So everybody's moving towards a common goal. When I don't have all that vision together in advance, that's usually when the project doesn't turn out as well as I hope. There's been quite a few of those, you know, where it's just, if I didn't have it all in my head, it doesn't, you know, from the beginning. Now you make compromises along the way, you find better ideas. Obviously you collaborate with people, but if you don't have a clear vision, whether it's the final vision or not, a clear vision going in, those are the projects that never quite work out. And the U is just one where it's like, I knew exactly how we should do it and how it should look and what the music should sound like. I said, I want the music to be like classic, you know, Aaron Copland, John Williams, like NFL film style orchestral music filtered through an 808, through Miami bass music of that era. So like, as soon as we nailed that, like, it was like, okay, now like it makes sense. There's a vision. I'll tell you an interesting story. A very dear friend of mine, he is blind. He had retinitis pigmentosa and lost his eyesight over the course of from teenagehood to adulthood. And one night, he and I'm dropping him off at his place. And I guess this is years ago, my iPod was plugged in. And it started to play the U soundtrack, the U score. And it was all the music from the movie, including the Uncle Luke theme song, all in order, in chronological order. Somehow, I don't know how this happened, we wind up sitting in his driveway for like an hour and a half, listening to the entire soundtrack in chronological order while I described to him what was happening in the documentary, kind of scene for scene, cue for cue, beat for beat. And this is a lot of years ago, but every once in a while, Isaac will bring it up to me. He'll go like, that was the most incredible, most fun night just like he goes, like, because the music told the story. And so I was able to describe to him what was happening in this documentary, what some of the guys were saying while listening to this music. And it was like a musical, like it brought it all to life.
That is a very cool story.
Amazing. And you wrote some of the music, right? I mean, what was that like? Are you a music writer? Because yeah, I saw you on the credits. I'm really like, puppet.
Yeah. No, I wrote one of the themes. I did that on some of our docs. Sometimes when you're like on set, you just start singing, you know, like you just, you know, and that's always a good sign for me when the documentary starts singing to you or you start singing along to the documentary while you're making it. That's a pretty good sign, you know. And so that just happened here. I sat down at a piano and figured out this theme. And then the composers, the really, when it comes to music, I'm all passion, no talent. So I kind of play it out. And then the composers who have the real talent and arranging capabilities integrate that theme into the score. I did that on Square Grouper, The Godfathers of Ganja, on Dogfight, on The U Part One, maybe a couple others, on Raw Deal. Yeah, a couple others. Like, you just get inspired, you know, like you just, you know, you're on a project and you just like, this is, listen, I wrote the hook, The U. It's all about The U. It's all about The U. It's all about The U. You say it. Then I'll go like, so yes. So I wouldn't call myself a poet or a musical genius exactly, but that shit worked, you know?
You got to work. You worked with Uncle Luke. That's like, that must have been like legendary.
I worked with Uncle Luke in a room full of, you know, chorus who would like yell back, you know, we did the call and response shit live in the room at a studio in little Haiti. Yeah.
There's so many great interviews in the documentary. Who was your favorite and who were you possibly bummed that you didn't get?
Well, everybody we didn't get, I was bummed that we didn't get, but we got a lot of great interviews. Certainly more people say no than say yes. And when you're covering what, four national championship teams at that time with three different head coaches, there's a lot of people to interview, you know, from head coaches to assistant coaches to players. I mean, it's a ridiculous number of people because there was nobody, very few people, I should say, were there that entire time. Art Kehoe was certainly one of them, you know, but like no, very few people covered, you know, maybe basically 84 to, to the end of the decade, like it was very few. So we asked as many people as we could get in touch with. I think on the first documentary, I think my favorite interview had to be Jimmy Johnson. I think I had a lot of fun. I really enjoyed
it. He looked so good on the water. He looked so good.
Exactly. It was set up great.
Like, yeah. He was just like, he looked like Mr. Miami right there.
He did. But Bernie Kosar was great. He and I became friendly. You know, he was later in our Broke documentary. He was one of the nicest guys. Melvin Bratton. I loved interviewing Melvin Bratton. Yeah. I loved interviewing Alonzo Highsmith. Loved it. Alonzo Highsmith, who looked like he was ready to get out on the field. Like in that, I mean, he is fucking, I mean, just like in shape,
stacked.
Yeah. Like he could bench like three of me in those days. Like, there was some great interviews there. I mean, like then I just had a blast with the guys, you know, doing.
Well, Mel was what I wanted to ask you about, because he told the great Bosworth story, which I had never heard. How did you vet some of these stories? Because some of them seem like folklore, like, oh, the Dolphins couldn't get in and we could get in the club. But like that Bosworth story, did you know it beforehand? Did they tell you that and you just pieced it together so well? Like, how did that happen?
Yeah, some of these stuff, you know, we had pre-interviews. We had done a lot of research. There's a lot of these stories that you don't know if they're apocryphal or if they're true. And then you get these guys in a room and you finally get to ask them about it. And there's some great deleted scenes too on the DVD and Blu-ray and on YouTube. That were just amazing stories that a lot of these we knew in advance. And so we're prepared, you know, with the B-roll that we needed and what we needed to dig up from the archives and the game footage. But then like there's details you don't know. So they walk you through it and then you have to just piece it together and find the right footage to intercut. Sports docs are fun that way. There's a lot of footage, you know, that you have access to and you get to use. Not every doc you have the advantage of having the right B-roll and archive that you need available to you.
I wanted to ask, you do a great job with archive footage. For our listeners out there, what is kind of your ethos about archives, about finding it, that kind of part of the process? What is your kind of talk through your ethos about archive footage?
My producing partner, Alfred Spellman, calls what we do synthesis journalism. You know, very rarely do we originate, you know, a story or a piece of journalism. We're often standing on the shoulders of giants, whether it's the people who actually lived these experiences or it's the journalists that have already covered them in the past. You know, in the case of Cocaine Cowboys, of course, we had dozens of hours of local news archive footage at our disposal to integrate into the documentary, thanks to the Florida Moving Image Archive, now housed at Miami-Dade College on the Wilson campus in downtown Miami, which prior to that was housed in the basement of the main library, a few blocks away in downtown Miami. An extraordinary resource. I'm terribly grateful to Miami-Dade College and the Wilsons for maintaining and financing. It is, you know, Miami is one of the youngest cities in America. And so as a result, you know, and of course, culturally, we have a transient population and a real lack of institutional memory. Like any young city or any young person, we are kind of America's perpetual belligerent adolescent. You know, we just like, we don't really preserve or respect our history. We're only interested in the new shit, right? Knock the old shit down, build the new shit. You know, every kid, I want the new, the old iPhone isn't good enough. I need the new one, right? Everything's the new shit, the new shit, the new shit. So Miami is like that. You know, we don't value our history. The hustle is knocking shit down, redesigning, rebuilding. That's the hustle, is the new shit. You know, and because there's no money in preserving history, right? So we need nonprofits and colleges like Miami-Dade and generous families, you know, wealthy families like the Wolfsons who help to preserve that history. It's not profitable, but it is priceless. So that's incredibly important. Shout out to everyone at the Florida Moving Image Archive. On Cocaine Cowboys, we started with the archive.
Like, do you push? Are you one of the types that push and say, "There's got to be something out there. We got to find it. We got to find it. We got to find it. There's got to be footage."
Yeah, I'm impossible that way. Yeah.
Okay.
And we rarely give up. Like, even when we've exhausted all of our all of our resources and or known resources, I still often push a little bit further to, you know, to scrape the bottom of the barrel to see what it is that we can find out there, if there's something in particular or special that we're looking for. But so oftentimes we don't find exactly what we're looking for, but you know, as the famous poet once said, you can't always get what you want, but if you try sometimes, you just might find you get what you need.
So I got to ask you, for the Kane fans on that are listening, when the Canes went 10-0 under Mark Richt, I'm like, Billy Corbin has to be thinking about part three of the U. It's like, you know, they beat Notre Dame, is going crazy. I'm like, what will it take for you to do a part three, and where would you start it? I have in my head Clemson, Al Golden gets fired, boom, you go from there. But have you even thought about that, or is that something you're not even wasting your time with?
More the latter than the former.
Fair enough.
I think we're pretty far away from the history that needs to occur in order for us to even then live long enough to have that history in our rear view, so we can retell it, you know, and re-record it and capture it. But like, you know, that Notre Dame game that you're talking about was as electrifying an environment as I've ever experienced at a football game. That includes the Orange Bowl, that includes the Super Bowls that I've attended at Joe Robbie Stadium. That was as exciting as football gets. I think that, you know, we have to be somewhat content with those occasional 10 win seasons. I think that's the reality of the game now in college football in Miami. I hate to say it, it gives me no joy to say it, but the reality is, you know, I think, you know, you got to win the ACC and then you got to win a national championship, not necessarily in that order, but you certainly have to do the latter in order to even consider, you know, the U is back kind of nonsense that everybody, listen, that's why there's an off season, and that's why they're called fans. It's short for fanatic, you know, and fanatics don't exist in any rational world of fact and logic, they exist. It's all in their hearts, right? It's all what you can convince them to believe. Next season is our season. It's never our season. I've been a Dolphins fan long enough to know that. So it's never our year, right? Like, let's start there and then let everything else be a pleasant surprise, right? Lower your expectations and you're less likely to be disappointed, right? But the reality is, AJ, let's be real. They got to win a fucking championship, okay? And then plus 10 years or 20, 15 or 20 years. So like I said, knock wood, we should all live that long.
That's what I actually take from that. You know, the fan side, yeah, I agree with you 100%. But I think it's the removing the 10 years long enough to be able to say, hey, that to me is the interesting part that you've said a few times that is important and part of the storytelling.
A story has to ripen. That's what we call it. A story has to ripen. You know, there's so much nonfiction content these days that people are making documentaries. They're so busy making documentaries, they're barely living life. You know, people are doing it for the gram. They're doing it for a docu-soap, a reality series. They're like, I mean, like there was like, you know, two Fire Festival documentaries. The thing, I mean, the, you know, was still being litigated for crying out loud. Like you know, the benefit of, you know, the benefit of hindsight, or I should say the benefit of the hindsight is extremely beneficial to documentary filmmaking. How are you supposed to synthesize? How are you supposed to really take an objective look at history if you are in the middle of it? I mean, if you're living of it, things have to settle down. Criminal cases have to resolve themselves in order to, you know, stories have to ripen. People have to be ready to confront their demons and tell their truth in an honest way. A lot of people are, you know, get so caught up in revisionist history, especially when you're living it, when you're spinning it. If you're in the middle of the spin, you're never going to get the best doc, or you might get an entertaining documentary, but you're not going to really be able to recreate that history without a little bit of distance and objectivity. You need people to be able to, you know, be at a stage of their life where they're looking back at their younger self. None of us are ever objective about ourselves. It's tough to see the forest for the trees, but in a way where you're at least able to be critical and laugh at yourself and kind of say, like, you know, put yourself in that frame of mind, but also, you know, from a standpoint of the next phase of your life. And I just think that a lot of docs these days, especially with the ubiquity of documentary content on every network and every platform, people are sort of in a race to get documentaries done. We're guilty of that as well. It's just the game now, you know, but like, I think that any history needs a minimum plus 10 years to get through, or at the very least, again, get through the other side of like, get to the end of the story, you know, where, you know, like that's what we did with Screwball. At least, you know, Tony Bosch got out of prison. Like he, you know, like let's find a comfortable place in the world of the story where it's over and at least we can tell that part of their history with a beginning, a middle, and end with three acts.
Absolutely. A great lead into our third act. But if you haven't seen The U, I know most of us have seen it out there, but definitely go check it out on ESPN Plus.
And watch it back if you see it.
I watched two back.
Oh man, but it's so much stuff in there. It just, you get sucked in. My girl's like, oh, Nevin Shapiro, I forgot about this. This morning, she was going on and on and on. And the panic case, there's just so
unrelated,
much.
Not related.
If you watch them back to back, you know, you'll realize they're just the same movie, to be perfectly honest. You know, and that's really probably what'll happen if and when there's ever a U part three. It'll be another rise and fall, right? That'll be the arc. But it's really the same movie the second time. And in fact, cutting room floor of The U part one, which is important because it literally would be the same friggin' story. When Howard Schnellenberger took over the program in 79, the U had been decimated by NCAA sanctions from from the Saban, the Lou Saban generation. He left the place in a wreck, in a shambles. And so when Howard came in, rest in peace, Howard Schnellenberger, when Howard came in, he was once again, just like Butch Davis would later, was coming in hamstrung, you know, recruiting with his hands tied behind his back, you know? So that's part of what drove limitations breed creativity. I always say that as an indie filmmaker, but that's what Howard was dealing with. That's why he said, well, We need to do a lot of local recruiting because we can't afford to put our coaches on airplanes, you know, to fly around the country to look for key players. We better take advantage of the homegrown talent that we have, which of course turned into a genius, you know, a genius strategy that has been duplicated all over the country in college football programs. But, I think that realizing that and realizing the start of the U part two with, again, sanctions, coach coming in, trying to, you know, build a program up from nothing. It's the same story. And I'll tell you, here's an interesting story. So in the U part one, we're recording the soundtrack in Little Haiti. And I wrote this theme and I wanted to the end of the movie, spoiler alert, when the Orange Bowl is being torn down. Because we're filming the documentary while the Orange Bowl was being torn down. And so we went and shot some of that footage, and that is in the documentary as the metaphor, of course, for the end of that era, right? And so, which is funny, we did the same thing in Cocaine Cowboys. They demolished the Harbor House while we were shooting Cocaine Cowboys, which was a key location to Mickey Munday and his smuggling operation. And we used that same, which is just what Martin Scorsese did in at the end of Casino. You know, there's no better end of the era symbolism than a fucking building being torn apart, you know. So from the era. So anyway, long story even longer. We wrote this cue for the end of the U part one that is absolutely heart-wrenching. It's like devastating. It's this big orchestral cue, tragic, very high strings, like, and we played it against the end of the U part one, that epilogue, you know, where guys are reminiscing, intercut with the footage of the Orange Bowl, it'll never be the same again, et cetera, et cetera. And I was like, okay, this is too much. It's just too much. Like, it's overwrought. Like I said, listen, we didn't earn it. You know, I said, it's a powerful ending, but we just didn't earn it. It's just too big. It was like Schindler's List. It was like this really epic, tragic cue. I'm like, this is just too much. And we went a different direction with it. We replaced that cue. And so flash forward 11, 12, 13, 5 years later, we're doing the U part two. Coming right down to the wire, trying to get the movie done, trying to get the score finished. We're down to the last cue of the movie. This is true. And composer's like, what do you want to do here? And it's like the same sequence. It's like, it's a different generation of players, but intercut with, like, you know, the team starting to lose under Al Golden. And, you know, and again, there's plane banners, just like there were at the beginning of the story for Butch Davis, you know, saying Al Golden, you know, should quit, whatever. And so I said, you know, I have an idea. We wrote this cue 5 years ago for the end of the U part one. Let's drop it in and just see how it works. It was perfect. It timed perfectly. And there was something about it, because we're now 4 hours into the story, right? With the U part two, we had earned it. We had earned the tragedy. We had earned the fact that we had relived this rise and fall in a second generation. For some reason, like, at the end of 2 hours, we hadn't earned it. At the end of 4 hours, we had earned it. And so we remixed that cue. And that cue, otherwise verbatim, became the end of the U part two that we had written 5 years earlier for essentially the same sequence, the epilogue. But I don't even think we changed the timing. Somehow David Sipkin, who had edited the first documentary as well, it's like when you drop a piece of music in and it works perfectly. And it was that moment where I was like, I'm like, we may not be one hit wonders, but we might be one trick ponies.
Mic drop on that. Like the wrecking ball going through the Orange Bowl, we're gonna head into Act Three for a couple quick hitters.
Like Miley Cyrus.
Exactly. Like the Orange Bowl being demolished. Couple quick hitters here. Opinion on athlete-produced documentaries.
I think there's a lot of potential. It's like writing an autobiography. You know, we make first-person productions. We rely on stories coming right from the horse's mouth. It's all about I and we, not they and he. You can always find somebody else to talk about, you know, sports. Can you get the people who lived the history and made the history to tell their stories? So I think that there's a lot of, there's an upside to it. I think the problem is, of course, the lack of objectivity, the idea that it turns into, you know, sports porn or propaganda, you know, self-aggrandizement. I think it helps to bring in filmmakers that you respect to help co-create, to help co-produce, co-direct. And I think it's important to give those filmmakers a lot of latitude, and if not final cut, at least a lot of latitude. I think that, you know, I see the pros and cons. The reality is that, you know, a lot of athletes who have have a lot of, you know, power and fame, can control their own destinies and stories, as they should. I mean, it's their story, you know? But I think that they need to collaborate, you know, they need to collaborate, and they need to share, narrative duties and let other people come in with their truth and maybe a little bit more objectivity.
Very diplomatic answer. I like that. One filmmaker,
but it's a legitimate. It's a legitimate form. I don't. That's the thing. Is that, like, you know, I, the idea of, you know, and even family members. You know, the offspring. There's a lot of documentaries. There's a tradition of children, you know, sons and daughters of interesting, not just athletes, but just of famous people or interesting people doing stories about their parents. I just think that's a very legitimate and viable genre of filmmaking.
One filmmaker you'd like to have dinner with?
A filmmaker, Billy Wilder. He's dead, though.
But that's still a good answer. What would you?
Yeah. Honestly, Even having dinner with him now, he'd probably be the funniest person ever. even in his present condition.
Favorite rap lyric about one of your movies?
Oh, shit.
Give it to us. Give it to us.
I don't even know that I know all of the rap lyrics about it. I feel like Cocaine Cowboys and a lot of the subjects in Cocaine Cowboys get name dropped quite frequently. I'm trying to think of a good, like, Griselda Blanco one. I feel like she gets the godmother, La Madrina. I feel like she gets a lot of shout outs.
Nas, Drake, Trick Daddy.
You know, Nori did a great Cocaine Cowboys song that actually sampled Jan Hammer's score from the documentary. It was pretty badass. It was on a Wally Sparks mixtape that came out around the time of the documentary, which was pretty fantastic. I'm just trying to think of, like, there, I know I got it in my like on the tip of my tongue. There's a Griselda Blanco name drop, and I just can't think of the artist. I feel like it comes up. It used to come up not infrequently. I feel. I think Rick Ross has a great one too. Yeah, I'm always very, I think that, you know, hip hop is for a time became like sort of American narco corridos, you know, like, you know, songs that sort of treat these characters as like folk heroes, which is very interesting. A lot of it, I think, is because of that, you know, that Tony Montana-esque, you know, rags to riches, inspirational kinds of stories, and hip hop speaks to that a great deal.
Last one for me. What person have you interviewed that's made the biggest impression on you or you've worked with?
Well, obviously, Ron Howard, as I said earlier, very funny. Yes. We were doing a documentary miniseries for VH1 called The Tanning of America, One Nation Under Hip Hop. And I got to interview Ron Howard for that because he was talking about how the tanning of television and, you know, Norman Lear and some of his early sitcoms about Black American families, you know, and how influential that was. And he talked about how when Good Times got programmed against Happy Days, they were getting their ass kicked in the ratings, and in no small part because of Jimmy Walker. And that was when actually Fonzie started to have a bigger role, and like all of his, you know, Fonzie started to, you know, had his, you know, his sort of trademark sayings and, you know, like his own, his version of Dynamite, basically.
Yeah,
you know, and so
he was
like,
cool.
And so Yeah. And so like they needed Fonzie to like sort of be the Jimmy Walker, you know, like in to try to go head to head. Needless to say, I don't think Fonzie won in that in that battle, but for coolness. But here I am, the filmmaker who inspired me really to become a director, and now I'm interviewing him for a documentary miniseries, you know, that I was directing and producing with Steve Stout. That was pretty special, and I got to duplicate a picture with Ron that I took on the set of Parenthood in 1988, on set of Tanning in like 2014-ish. So that's pretty cool when you kind of get to meet your hero again and tell them, you know, like you inspired. I'm only here interviewing you because I watched you direct on set of Parenthood in 1988 in Orlando, and here I am.
Last one for me. We're talking sports documentaries. Who would you want to hear on this podcast?
Well, Pat Riley.
I think we can make that happen.
Ooh. Yeah. I mean, I told you, I you know, people have come to me, and this goes to the issue earlier of when is a story ripen, right? When's a good time to tell a story? So for years, I mean, people have been like, you got to do a big three, right? You got to do big three, Miami Heat documentary, right? And so I'm like, too soon, bro. You know, too soon. Settle down. Tranquilo, you know, like, because first thing that has to happen is they all have to retire. Okay. Two down, right? One to go, you know, and then you need to plus 10, you know, you need some hindsight, you need some distance to gain perspective, to get, I think, the most fun and candid interviews out of everyone. But for me, that's not a sports story. A lot of sports stories are being told. I want to tell a front office TikTok. I want that to be a sports business story. I want to understand how those moves were made, the guys hitting each other up, helping to recruit each other into it. I think that is the story. The story is not, you know, the story is not these guys in shorts and jerseys. It's them in three-piece suits signing contracts with lots of zeros in them. That and how, you know, and sort of the puppet master behind, you know, behind the scenes making that all happen. That to me is, you know, those are docs that I'd like to, the sports business stories, I think, are the docs I'd like to make and that I'd like to see moving forward. And that to me is the real story of the big three that people that I want to see. You know, yeah, you could make a million documentaries about championships, not one, not two, not three. I get it. But like really the story about how they came to win, you know, not one championship. That's the story to me. And that's the story that I'd like to make and I'd like to see.
Appreciate your time, Billy. Really do. You've given us a lot and you've given us our listeners a lot. So really appreciate the time you've given us.
Anytime. Thanks, AJ. Thanks, Ed.
A big thank you to Miami's finest, Billy Corbin, giving us his valuable time and dropping some serious knowledge. Please subscribe, rate, and review the show. And if you do, we'll give you a big shout out or even bring you on. If you like what you heard, please share with your friends. We'll be back next week with another great episode of Beyond the Lens. And that's a wrap.